Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, Mets fans. This is Rich Farrago, known as CT Mets Fan on Twitter, and you are listening to an edition, a very special edition of the Metsian podcast. And I say it's a very special edition because we have a very special guest. So I'd like to tell you who that is. That's Mr. Nick Davis, who is a television movie and producer. So let me just tell you a little bit about some of the things that Nick has done. Well, you know, his range goes from the Emmy Award-winning Jack, the last Kennedy film, which he did in 1993. It goes to having written an episode of The Bronx is Burning, also to the television series Making News, Texas Style, Texas Monthly. And back to baseball, Nick did something, an American Masters program on Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived, and probably to everyone listening, Nick Davis is best known for Once Upon a Time in Queens, a four-part story about the 1986 New York Mets that was part of ESPN's 30 for 30. And I am thrilled to have Nick Davis with me tonight. Sam and Mike both are unable to join. I'm thrilled to have Nick Davis with me tonight to talk Mets baseball and talk about some of the great works he's done. So, Nick, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, that's great. Our pleasure is all ours, Nick. And so, you know, here you are. I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself because your background is so varied and so interesting. But let's start here. Let's start with, you're a native New Yorker, and you're a Mets fan. And so how did that happen? I mean, you know, obviously you can go any way you want in terms of baseball fandom, but if you're a native New Yorker, you're probably going to go one of two ways. So how did you become a Mets fan, Nick?
Well, that's a great question. I think that I just very naturally went in the Mets direction. And to be honest, it probably was because I was born in 65. So my first awareness really of baseball was the Mets had just won the World Series. So I came into consciousness with this wonderful thing of this colorful, bright, young miracle having just happened. And they wore this great blue and orange, you know, that I really liked. And I never liked the Yankees colors. And so when I first really became a baseball fan consciously was 1970. And I just remember that the Mets had won. And I like to pretend that I remembered them winning, but I didn't. And so, yeah, they just were my lifelong team. I was going to say affliction ever since. And that was it. And then, you know, I just obviously have followed them avidly. And we were also huge Willie Mays fans in my family. And I sort of retroactively was a New York Giants fan. I always sort of tended towards the Giants, not the Dodgers. And we got tickets to see the Mets play the Giants because we were going to go see Willie Mays play. And it was Mother's Day in 1972. And I was 7 years old and we were looking forward to seeing Willie Mays on the Giants. And lo and behold, before that game happened, a few days before, Willie Mays was traded to the Mets. So we were there at his first game back in New York as a Met and saw his tremendous home run, and it was one of the great early memories of my life was Mother's Day 1972. So that cemented it. If there was any doubt before that day, that made me a Met fan for life.
You know, your story is very interesting and particularly to me because it's very similar to mine. We're exactly the same age, born the same year. And, we were four when the Mets won the World Series. And I honestly, I can't tell you, I remember it either. I remember a little, like right. The little black and white TV in the kitchen, right, with mom watching it because it was a day game at the time.
Right.
Cousins, everybody on my side, all Yankees fans. But this new shiny toy with a bright blue helmet and the nice orange NY that had just won. That's going to be my team, man. I don't care who anybody else likes. That's my team.
Right.
And
right.
Let's go to 1973 real quick, right? So we are 8 years old in 1973. How devastated were you when they lost to the A's?
I wasn't that devastated because I just didn't know any better. I didn't know enough to be devastated in the moment. I remember the winter afterwards getting very devastated and sort of replaying it again and again in my mind and thinking, wait a minute, I don't understand. Why didn't George Stone start game six? They should have held Seabrook. But like in the moment, I just wasn't, it didn't hit me the way later defeats would. And it was only in retrospect, really in the winter between 73 and 74, that I started really just obsessing about what had just happened and how close we had come and that we should have won that World Series.
Pretty much the same. I think I took the approach of if they were in the World Series, they were going to win because they had won the previous time, right? I just didn't contemplate
right.
how could they
totally.
Lose.
Yeah.
All right, and I just have to ask a few more unscheduled questions here because of our similar paths. Seavers traded. We'll just jump ahead a few years. Exactly the effect on you when that happened.
So that was the worst. That was utterly devastating. And I was, we really are, I guess, the exact same age, so that's kind of amazing, Rich. But I was home that night, and I was listening to the game. I don't even think the game was on TV. I was listening to the game on the radio, and it was obvious that something was brewing. The Mets were in Atlanta, and it was clear, like, this, it could happen. It might not happen, but it seems like it really could happen. And then lo and behold, it did happen. And it really was, I mean, you know, I don't want to put too much of it, but it was like the end of my childhood. That was it. Like, it was so devastating and such a gut punch. And we were already bad that year. But this just made it just felt like we dropped off the edge of the earth. And it was just a miserable, miserable summer. And I don't know if you remember, but, you know, the All-Star game that year was in Yankee Stadium. And Seaver, obviously, was selected to the team, came back and pitched at Yankee Stadium. And I was at summer camp and was surrounded by a bunch of just total jerks. And he pitched badly, and he gave up a home run to Yastrzemski, and the whole room was just jeering at him. And he finally got the third out of the inning, and I remember storming out and slamming the screen door behind me and just, like, going out into the night. I was just like, these idiots don't know anything, and this game means nothing. It's an exhibition game, and why are I was so upset. So that was summer 77, which was pretty bleak. And so, you know, to jump ahead, when I did what became Once Upon a Time in Queens, the four-parter about the 86 Mets, I knew that that's where the story began. The story began in the summer of 77, because that was the low point for the franchise. And how does that team turn around from that misery, the summer of 77, the trade, and the city in the toilet, how does that, the seeds of that become the glory and ridiculousness of the 86 Mets?
And I say this in all candor, that's part of the brilliance of your work on the Once Upon a Time in Queens, it's how you told that story of, you know, the Son of Sam and the blackout and all that in 77 and the trade of Seaver, and then the city goes through, which it always does. It goes down, then it comes back up. And you had the wildness of the mid-80s, you know, with everybody partying and, you know, the city was booming and all of that. So I want to ask you one more Mets question, though, and see if we're really cut from the same Mets cloth, because this is my thing. So I was devastated when Seaver was traded too, and Kingman, I could care less, but that, you know, with Seaver.
Yes, that was the weird thing. It's like the next day, it was like the Midnight Massacre. They traded Seaver. It's like, Kingman, who cares? You know, like, ooh. Kingman was so, but at the time in the newspapers, it was like, oh my God, these two devastating trades. And it was like, yeah, I guess, you know, but it was all the Seabrook trade.
Exactly. But let me ask you this one. The one that got me as much as the Seaver trade predated it, the trade of Staub. Are you as crazy about Rusty Staub as I was, or should I say, were you as crazy about Rusty Staub as I was? Because let me just give 1 second of context on that. When you and I were becoming Mets fans early 70s, I remember watching the game like 70, 71, and this redheaded guy who was so damn good playing for the Expos, I remember telling my father, why can't the Mets get that guy? This guy is something. And then the Mets get the guy. And he leads them in 1973. He's the first one to drive in 100 runs in 1975. I was crushed when they traded Rusty. Where did you stand on Rusty?
I was pretty annoyed when they traded Rusty. I still had hope for Mickey Lalich. It was probably 2 or 3 years past his legitimately generating that hope. But I hated the trade. I didn't understand the trade. He just knocked in the record 105 runs. But I sort of thought, well, maybe they're doing something. And of course they weren't. No, Staub was amazing. I didn't really have that feeling about him on the Expos as you did, but when he came to the Mets in 72 and he was leading us in 72, I mean, I felt like, oh my God, people forget, like, the 72 team, until he hurt his wrist or whatever, he got hurt. But like, we were, you know, we had the 11 game winning streak and it was sort of like, okay, 72, here we go. And then he got injured and they sort of fell off, significantly. But still had the second best record up until that point that the team had ever had. Yeah, Staub was great. The trade of Staub it was one of those things where I was a little slow to figure out what a bad trade that was. And also, Mike Vail had just come up and he'd had the 23-game hitting streak, so it sort of seemed like, all right, it makes sense. They got this great Mike Vail. I mean, that was obviously that didn't work out. But interesting. Yeah, we really have parallel fandoms.
We do, and not to mention Rusty's heroics in 1973, playing with separated shoulder.
Yes,
playing with no long sleeve shirt on, and the step. I remember it was like 35 degrees that night at Shea, right? So Nick, where I want to go with this next, of course, I want to do a very deep dive into Once Upon a Time in Queens, but before getting there, you have done such an array of work in baseball, outside of baseball. I see your Harvard grad, all of that. Tell me a little bit more about how you, what's the right word to use? Vacillated between secular topics, not that baseball wasn't a secular topic, and baseball. So you would do Kennedy and Texas news, but then something on baseball. So what is it like to be able to do that in all those different arenas? Interest of yours, or how did...
Yeah, I mean, it's really sort of a couple of things. One is just sort of following my nose, and when I'm lucky enough to generate my own stuff, which doesn't always happen. Like, often, you know, you're just looking for work or somebody asks you to do something and it's like, oh, this is interesting. The thing I would say is I do love baseball. And when my first job in film was actually on the Ken Burns baseball series. I was an intern on that, and remember Ken saying at one point, like, he had just done Civil War. And so I remember him saying, you know, that when people talk about Civil War, like, you know, it was intense and it was, you know, heady and sometimes depressing and dark and serious. And he said, like, I'm just really enjoying talking to people about baseball because their faces light up. And they enjoy talking about it. And I have found in my career that the older I get and the more I go along, the more I want to talk to people about things that make them happy. It's not like I don't do serious films. I'm doing a very serious film now, but I'm also doing one, you know, on baseball. And it just puts you in a better mood to be working with material where people are excited to tell you about this rally and, you know, whatever, whether it's, you know, the ninth inning in Houston in game six or the 10th inning in game six against the Red Sox, whatever, like people remember it and their faces light up, or even if it's a Red Sox fan or a Red Sox player, it's not life and death. It's sports and it's fun. And so there's something really invigorating and sort of uplifting about working with material where that is the sort of constant is the joy that people get when they talk about baseball, for the most part. I mean, if they're not talking about, you know, the designated hitter or, you know, the shift or, you know, like things that are irritating about baseball, but like, it's not life and death. It's fun. And so I have found more and more that that's how I like spending my time and my days. And so I've done, you know, after years away, and I didn't do any baseball after the baseball film. I never worked on another baseball film until Ted Williams. And then I just loved working on Ted Williams. I'm not a Red Sox fan. I didn't know that much about Ted Williams before working on it, but I loved the process of immersing myself in baseball again. And so while working on that, I thought, oh my gosh, why has no one ever done the 86 Mets? Let me see if I can make that happen. And I was lucky enough to sort of be in the right place at the right time on that.
Great segue. So now I'd really like to focus on Once Upon a Time in Queens. So there are so many things I want to say about it, but I want you to do all the talking. So let me just say this. When people think about the 86 Mets, there are, from a layperson's perspective like mine, so many different ways you could take it. You could take it from the cockiness of the team. You could take it from the perspective of the Mets fan that had been starved for something for so long and, you know, came just short in 85. You could do that. You could talk about the resilience, if that's what you want to call it. How many years ago was it, but I'm not even sure I understand the right word for it, because were they resilient? Yes, they were. But on the other hand, they were supposed to win. They were the better team. At least the Astros had the pitching, yes. But the way the Mets ran roughshod over everyone, it was an outcome that seemed to be pre-scripted. Of course, nothing ever is in sports. But then they almost lost it, but they came back. So is that resilience or is that almost choking it away? Who knows? Who cares? They won. But you took it from such an interesting perspective with where New York was in the 70s. You said it yourself, you know, a few minutes ago, that the Mets were down, the city was down. And I remember the summer of 77 with the Son of Sam killer. And, you know, here I was living 50 miles from the city, but I was still afraid of the guy, you know, as a 12-year-old. So you took it from that perspective into the wildness of the mid-80s, and the Mets plugged right into that. You know, it's in your series or some of the shots in the bars and things like that, to the team, to the whole Dwight Gooden thing about, you know, the unfortunate part of that. So if you could tell us how you got there, like how you got to the point of wanting to tell the story in that particular way, and how it developed, and anything you'd like to share with us about key moments as you talk to people, we'd love to hear it.
Well, I think that the thing about that team that struck me at the time, and then even more so looking back, is that I had never seen a team that was so infused with the spirit of the time and place that it was a part of. Like, you know, the way I would always talk about the film to people in the, you know, and the development of it was like, it's about a team and a time and a place. And it was fused. Like, you don't take the 1986 New York Mets and put them in, you know, any other city or any other time and expect that story to be as resonant as it was. There was something about that city and that team that just was like this love affair. But it was more than that. It was like they captured the city's spirit, or they seemed to. And a lot of people felt it. And those are the kinds of things that, like, I usually really resist saying. And, in fact, you know, it's not like the I don't use a narrator. And so the film doesn't actually ever come out and say it. but it's sort of that's what the film shows, is that the city was wild, the team was wild. The city had seemed to have no rules, the team seemed to have no rules. The city had this incredible cockiness and swagger, and no team has ever had more swagger than the 86 Mets, it could be argued. And they were incredibly good and talented and entertaining. So, you put that all together, and I felt like, what a fantastic story that I'm, getting to tell, or getting to, I don't really think of it as, I mean, everyone throws around this word storyteller and stuff. The way I work, I really don't feel like I'm telling the story. I'm just letting the story tell itself. So we interview everybody and talk to everybody we can think of who it feels like would have a voice in this, and then let them tell the story. You know, let Lenny Dykstra and Keith Hernandez and Daryl and Doc and all Kevin Mitchell and Ray Knight and all the players on the team, and then also, people who were there at the time in New York, Kurt Anderson and the uber Mets fan Greg Prince and Cyndi Lauper and John McEnroe and Mike Tyson and, Oliver Stone, who's making Wall Street, and writing Greed is Good in the summer of 86 is when he writes that line. And that just captured the ethos of the time and place, and sort of seemed kind of, perfect for the movie Wall Street, and also, sort of perfect for the 86 Mets. So, you talk to all those people and then you get out of the way and let the story tell itself. So that's sort of in a nutshell, how the film came into being.
That's very interesting to hear. Now, in the course of talking to everyone, I've always been interested to ask this question. I'm sure when you're going to talk to Lenny, you're going to talk to Doc this day or Daryl that day or Keith that day or Darling that day. Who surprised you the most? Because what I'm saying is, I'm assuming you had something of an idea. You've seen these guys play. You've seen them in other interviews. Perhaps you've talked to them yourself at various points. When you decide you want to do the Once Upon a Time in Queens, okay, today I'm talking to Doc, today I'm talking to Daryl, whatever it might be, which interview or interviews did not play out the way you thought they would? Whether it's a pleasant surprise, if you want to share a pleasant surprise, or even something that went in a different direction. I'm just curious to hear about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny. Almost all of them were smarter about baseball than I had anticipated. I really viewed them before the process. I viewed them as the most talented team I'd ever seen, the best team I'd ever seen, my favorite team, whatever. But I didn't know how smart they all were about baseball. Like just talking about hitting with any of them, with Ray Knight, with Keith, Keith, because he's such a good announcer, but like Wally Backman, the intricacies of certain games and moments and the way their minds work about baseball, I was continually blown away. And I feel like that was sort of one surprise. I mean, I think, Kevin Mitchell had a tee time. He had scheduled us to talk for like 45 minutes or something. By the time we got going, we had set up. We were doing it by Zoom because it was during the pandemic. So I was, I was in my office in New York and I had a crew in San Diego setting up, a laptop next to a camera, and he like had this tee time. Like, and we sat down, and he was like, "So my tee time's at 12:30. And I was like, "What? What are you talking about?" Like, I thought I made it clear. Like, and like we totally blew that out of the water. He was great, but he was giving me a hard time, sort of busting my chops all the time. But like, how long is this going to go? And then he would give these fantastic answers, and go on at length about, what he was thinking about, Schiraldi or whatever it was. There was really nobody who was disappointing. I mean, I think the one that blew me away the most probably was Dykstra, just because his problems have been, well-documented, and you sort of go in thinking like, I don't know what I'm getting into here. But he was amazing. It was this unbelievably profane, brilliant, moving, incredible, I don't want to call it a monologue because I did ask questions, but for the most part, it was a stunning performance that he gave from the moment he sat down in the chair to the end. And he began with the 5-minute, you know, utterly unprintable, unshowable, you know, Lenny Bruce worthy riff that was completely hilarious and couldn't use a single word of it. And by the end, he was reminding me of Brando in On the Waterfront. I mean, it was just heartbreaking and moving and real. And we did use some of that when he talks about, like, you know, I won a World Series in New York City with the Mets. Where do you go from there? Where do you go from there? Like, it was like, you know, I could have been a contender. Like, that was it. It was the highlight of his life. And it was so moving and so real. And, you know, there is something about him where people think he's crazy or whatever, but I feel like he's crazy like a fox. He was totally in control during that interview of everything that he was putting out there for us. So I felt like that was the interview where at the end of the day, you know, I felt like that was really something. And we have something very special in this interview. I mean, you know, they were all great, Keith and Daryl. Doc was heartbreaking. I mean, they were, each of them was, you know, in some ways more revealing than the last. But Dykstra's was in some ways the most surprising because I did go in thinking, anything we get from him will be a bonus. I didn't have a lot of expectations going into that one. And they were certainly well exceeded.
And that's very interesting to hear. And since that, and you touched on the fact that you did a lot of this during the height of the pandemic, so you had that additional challenge of having to use Zoom and technology as opposed to face-to-face. Were you able to get together with any of them face-to-face, or was it entirely over Zoom or technology?
Oh, yeah. No. We actually started shooting, I think, in February of 2020. So we had done you know, Davey and one of the Bobby Ojeda interviews and Doc and Keith, actually. We got Keith in the can. And then I think we interviewed Doc on March 9th. And people knew something was going on. You got to be careful and, you know. And then the pandemic hit and we were shut down and actually, you know, stopped full production for a couple of months and sort of reorganized. And then went back into full production, and most of the next, you know, the rest of the interviews were conducted via Zoom, unless they were in New York City, in which case I was able to go and mask up and stuff. But and with one huge exception, which was Daryl, I flew to St. Louis to interview Daryl, and you know, I just couldn't have come this far and not interview Daryl Strawberry in person. So Daryl was you know, and that was a tremendous day-long interview in his backyard in St. Louis, where he lived. I mean, it's so crazy. And it was one of the great lines that didn't make the film was he said, like, God has a great sense of humor that he would put me, after all this, in St. Louis.
So, right.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But, yeah.
So, Nick, thank you for sharing all of that. I find it all to be incredibly interesting. And since September 2021, when it came out, what have you been working on since? I see a few things here, but what would you like to tell people that you might be a current project of yours that they could look forward to?
Well, you know, gosh, I feel like if this were maybe – next Monday, I would be able to talk about something. I'm not yet able to talk about the project I've been working on that is baseball adjacent, that is very exciting, and I've been working on it a long time. But I'm just, you know, we haven't. I'm not at liberty to say. I'm sorry to say. I mean, I've done other things that I can talk about. You know, I published this book that well, I published two books. I published a companion book to Once Upon a Time in Queens, which is an oral history of the 86 Mets, also coincidentally entitled Once Upon a Time in Queens, that contains a lot of stories that we just didn't have time for in the film. But I also published a book about my grandfather and great uncle who were Hollywood figures. And that book was called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, A Dual Portrait. And I've been working on other films and stuff. But the next big one, I was actually hoping that something would happen today. It didn't happen. That was going to permit me to talk about it. But I'm sorry to say, I can't yet talk about it.
Understood. We'll look forward to hearing about that. We are at about 30 minutes and you're listening to Metsian Podcast and with our special guest, Nick Davis. And so Nick, now that we've talked about some of the work you've done, I think it's a good time to pivot over to the 2023 version of the New York Mets and kind of pick them apart a little bit. So let's just start with a very basic question. If someone were to tell you, don't you hate that? Someone were to tell you that they would be 14-9 after 23 games, playing 17 of those 23 games on the road, pretty good, right? Would you be okay with that?
Not only would I be okay with it, I am okay with it. I mean, I think, you know, it would have been great if we had won just one of the last two games on this road trip, so that if we'd had just like a killer road trip rather than a pretty good road trip. Obviously, you know, you construct a pitching staff around two 38 and 40-year-olds, you're asking for trouble. And they got trouble in the first month of the season, but they've weathered it pretty darn well. It's been very I'm pleased with how the team is playing. I also think that fandom needs to, or my fandom has adjusted in the last 2 years, really. The playoffs are a different thing. You don't need to win 101 games. And we found out last year, it doesn't really help you to win 101 games. You just have to be peaking at the right time and get in the playoffs. This is a very, very different kind of fandom than the way we grew up. I don't feel like, you know, kicking the side of the wall if we lose a game, because I feel like we just got to get our 90 wins. We get our 90 wins, 90, 92 to be safe, and we're going to get in the playoffs. And it's just, is Verlander going to be healthy then? Is Scherzer going to be healthy then? How is McGill going to be? How is Peterson going to be? How is Senga going to be? Which of our pitchers will be operating at peak efficiency? And is it possible that Diaz will come back? I mean, the other thing is, you know, if you had said, you know, list the injuries that we've had, including, you know, most significantly Diaz, like, and we would be 14-9. I think anybody would have accepted that. And, you know, you'd have to bring up Alvarez before he's ready, and thrust him into a 2 or 3 day a week starting job that might really retard his progress. I think we're doing okay. And I see a lot of consternation on Mets Twitter. But I feel like I don't know what people are looking for, because, you know, look at the Phillies last year, and just you don't have to, you can't be the 86 Mets every year. And this team is not constructed to be the 86 Mets. I think we're 2 or 3 or 4 years away from constructing a team that is like that team. I'm sort of all over the place here, but I feel pretty good about this team.
I do too, but you know, you mentioned several things I want to touch on. Let's go right to Alvarez, since you mentioned Alvarez. I think you're in the same place as I am, that he was rushed, and not nefariously so. They needed a catcher. Narvaez goes down, and, you know, they have Michael Perez, but he's a career 176 hitter, and you have Alvarez, who by Baseball America's number one prospect in the game. And so you bring him up, but that is the right thing to do. But at the same time, both things can be true. That is rushing him. I think what we're seeing is a guy, we saw it yesterday, tremendous power, hit that ball out of the strike zone, over the wall, all of that, but still no plate discipline, or at least has to develop into some plate discipline, still seems to overswing, still seems anxious. Would half a season at AAA remedy that? Maybe, maybe not. But it's clear that there are several. He might be just a touch behind the speed of the major league game. He might be putting too much pressure on himself, all of those things. So is that where you are with Alvarez as well?
Yeah, I feel like I was, as much as I wanted them, I wanted to see a full season of Alvarez this year. I felt like, I don't understand, like, isn't he ready? He sort of showed in spring training he's not. Like, he's not batty or baity. Like, you know, batty, I felt like, come on, give him the job, let's go. But Alvarez really doesn't, he didn't look ready in the spring, and I thought, all right, you know what, give him some seasoning and we'll be okay. And I feel like this could be a not good thing to have brought him up because of an injury where he's not being given the starting position. He's not playing every day. He shouldn't be. I mean, he's not ready to, but therefore it might really mess with his head. You know, defensively, he's looked pretty solid. I mean, he's made some bad throws, but he looks like he can manage a pitching staff. He looks like a solid catcher. I'm surprised by how unimpressive, it's not just his discipline. He just doesn't look like a great hitter to me. Like, you know, Strawberry, when they brought up Strawberry and he went through, you know, as Willie Mays did, and as a lot of these guys do, they go through these, you know, growing pains. But Strawberry always looked like, man, that is a gorgeous swing. I don't think Alvarez had such a great-looking swing. Like, he doesn't look like a guy. I hope that I'm proven wrong and he becomes the second coming of, you know, Pudge Rodriguez or something. But he just doesn't look that good to me. I'm rooting for him. But I was hoping I would, like, fall in love with his swing in the way that I did with Strawberries or Confortos or Batties now. Like, and maybe I just have a thing for a left-handed sweet swing, left-handed stroke. But I've been surprised by just, like, he doesn't look that good, which is a completely aesthetic feeling, and it has nothing to do with whether or not he'll be, you know, a great major league player. I'm worried that this is like going to be like a lost year for him. Whereas if they just given him a year at AAA and maybe brought him up when he was scorching the league down there, we would feel like we would learn more about him. I feel like I'm not sure how much we're really going to get out of him this year. I hope I'm wrong.
I think you may be right, because he was pressed into service and he's not playing every day, but I agree with you on the swing. The swing is a Dave Kingman-like home run cut at every pitch. You know, you don't see him adjusting the swing with two strikes, trying to go to right field or hit the ball through the middle, like Keith always said, you know, when you're in a slump, try to hit the ball right back through the middle. All you see is a Dave Kingman-like swing, and sometimes he's going to hit it and demonstrate that great power, but unfortunately, quite often, he's not. You know, if this guy is going to hit over 270, that's great, but you certainly don't seem to – his swing does not seem to predict that, right?
No, it doesn't. It's weird. And I feel like what's interesting is you know, there's four of them, right? There's Alvarez, there's Batty, there's Vientos, and Maurizio. And I feel like in some ways Alvarez and Batty are sort of like the chosen ones. And Maurizio and Vientos, it's almost like the organization doesn't really believe in them that much, especially Maurizio for some reason. Like, they've never really liked him, but he's scorching the ball and he looks incredible. And like, he's one of those guys who is going to just force his way into a major league job, I think. Vientos, I feel less good about. I know he's doing great, but I have a weird feeling about him. Like he's Mark Carrion 2.0. Like, I'm not convinced he's ever going to be a great player, but, anyway, it's exciting that we have young talent, you know, for the first time. I guess we had Alonso and McNeil, but it's great to see Alonso hitting the ball like this. I mean, very, very exciting.
It is. And I'm a big Mauricio fan, too, and I agree with you on Bientos as well. Bientos is – I want to believe in the guy, but there's something about him. The Mark Carrion 2.0 is very, very interesting analogy. But Mauricio, here's a guy who is a switch hitter, naturally athletic. He runs well. He's a natural shortstop, and I know they're giving him some run at some other positions now. He just seems like a guy who could be invaluable on this team. So let me ask you a question that kind of keeps me up at night, right? The Mets, to me, whiffed at the DH position. You know, remember in 2022, the National League is going to the DH, and the Mets are so well suited. They have all these guys. Well, the Mets' DHs last year were pretty bad, and they're worse this year. I'm not a big Daniel Vogelbach fan. You know, your right-handed DH, they kind of play with that a little bit. Sometimes it's Canna. Sometimes, you know, it could be Escobar now that Beatty's up. So would you, as much as I, like to see – I'd like to see Mauricio up and Vogelbach on. That's my take on it. But how about yourself?
That's interesting. There's something about Vogelbach is so lovable that I've never really I always sort of think, he's good to have around, you know. But, no, I would much rather – well, first of all, I hate the DH. So I feel like the Mets also hate the DH, and therefore their production has been the worst in the league. You know, it's like – but I – yeah, it's interesting. I guess you could bring up Mauricio, but it seems like a young player at DH, I don't know, feels like I mean, there isn't really a position for him. So maybe that is a good call. And – it was how predictable was it that Ruff would go back to the Giants and start like being there, being Ruff again? You know, that was just like a total. It was like a nightmare that Darren Ruff experienced.
It was, with Mauricio, he could DH and he could also left field is a bit unsettled at the moment. I like Canna, some fans don't. I do. But with left field being unsettled, you know, he might get some play there, or McNeil in left and Mauricio at second or whatever. You could probably, I don't want to use the Ben Zobrist analogy. I think Mauricio has the potential to be a much better player than Zobrist was, but he, you know, there's a guy you can plug in at different places and get him some run up here. You know, Escobar,
I love Escobar as a guy. He seems like a fantastic guy to have around. I feel like McNeil should be the second baseman. McNeil should be the second baseman and he should hit second and just stop messing around with McNeil, because one of these years you're going to ruin him by yanking him all over the field and him not knowing whether he's hitting second or fifth or sixth or seventh. The guy won the batting title. I don't understand why we're still experimenting with McNeil all over the place. To me, he's a good, solid second baseman. I also think Buck underrates Guillorme. I feel like Guillorme, I like how much Guillorme is playing lately. I don't know. I like a lot of guys on this team.
I do too. No, it's a very – Canna is a great – Canna's a great complementary player, and I don't mean that in a negative way. He plays a little first base. In a pinch, he could play third base. Of course, he's a natural left fielder. But he's a smart baseball player. He runs well enough, you know, in a situational kind of a setting. If you need a ball hit to the right side, let's just say it's the bottom of the 10th, the other team didn't score on the top of the 10th, and you have the ghost runner. I'm sure you don't like that because I don't like it either. And Canna's up leading off the inning.
It.
You know he'll do the right thing, right? And we'll talk about
it.
I want to get to the changes too. So you're right. They have a lot of good complementary pieces. It's just, to me, it just fascinates me how badly they whiffed at DH with all the money they spent. And it's just not – on some teams, it's such an offensive powerhouse position. And on this team, it's, you know, okay, Vogelbach walks a lot. Okay.
Other than Vogelbach, it's like they're – it's just an afterthought. It's like, well, who do we got? You know, but Vogelbach obviously can only really DH, so that must be what he's here for. But they haven't figured it out. Mauricio is an interesting idea. I mean, he's such a good hitter. Like, what would be so bad about saying, look, just give us 2 weeks. Let's see what you can do. Let's manufacture an injury for Sam or somebody and just bring him up and see what happens.
Love it. So let's go to this one. Let's go to Max Scherzer and the whole, which I think is kind of played out issue, but I think we should talk about it because it's a big one in Mets world. Let's talk about the whole rosin thing. So maybe you know more about this than I, but from what Ken Rosenthal said, yes, rosin is legal. Mixing it with your own sweat, okay. But at some point, and no one knows what that is, because it's not quantifiable, rosin becomes illegal if it becomes, if the ball, if your fingers become too sticky. Do you understand that? Because I really don't.
Well, I read one thing. I didn't read Rosenthal today. Maybe he talked about it, but that part of the problem was he went to wash his hands and he used alcohol to wash his hands, which only makes your hands stickier when it's mixed with the rosin. And then it was the rosin mixed with the alcohol that he had used to wash his hands, that they told him to wash his hands, that made it even worse. But I don't know. The whole thing seems so crazy. And the fact that I'd like to believe that, you know, it's never much of a defense when someone says, well, I'd have to be crazy to do that. Like, yeah, but maybe you are. And maybe you thought we would all, that's just not, people should stop using that as a defense. You know, like for doing anything. Like, yeah, people are crazy. People do crazy things. They think they can get away with them. I don't think Scherzer did anything intentionally. I just don't think he did, and it doesn't seem to have affected his spin rate or anything like that. But I don't quite understand the physics of it, and I find it very oh, gosh, I can totally talk about this. So what's interesting is, you know, it's all about the stickiness of the baseball. And there was talk about, you know, that maybe they're trying to make the baseballs themselves stickier. You may or may not know this, but every baseball before every game is rubbed up with mud. And this, it's a very particular kind of mud that comes from a single company that is run by one guy who goes and harvests this mud at a secret location somewhere near the Jersey Shore. And he ships this mud to every baseball team so that every team has the same mud that comes from this secret location, and it's rubbed up 144 baseballs before every game is rubbed up with this mud. And it works, and it keeps the baseballs, you know, from slipping out of the pitcher's hands. But Major League Baseball is trying to get rid of this guy now because that's no way to run a railroad. And if they could, in fact, manufacture the baseballs themselves so that they were sticky and didn't need the mud, then all the baseballs would be uniform. I've just made a short film about this man who does this mud. It's called Mud Man. And his name is Jim Bintliff, and he's a really fascinating character. So I can talk about that. I just did this short film as part of a series that is going to be on one of the streamers in the next, few months or a year at least. So I don't know about the particulars of rosin, but I do know that it's a major issue that Major League Baseball is trying to get these baseballs to be regulated now, because, you know, having to rub up these balls 144 between every game, before every game, at 30 stadiums, you know, 162 games a year, you know, 300,000 baseballs a year, all having to be rubbed with the same mud that comes from this secret location in New Jersey. It's sort of a ridiculous thing, but that's where baseball is.
And thank you for sharing that about your upcoming short film. But isn't the schedule still made by a couple in Brooklyn, like they do it with paper and pen? I've heard that that's true.
I mean, that's what's right. So cute. There are these funny little things that baseball still has, like the couple that does the schedule and the mud man and stuff, that like no other sport really has that sort of weird romantic thing. And it's one of the things that makes baseball so fun.
It really does. And so, all right. So for two guys, you know, 58 for me is in a couple of months. So basically the same age, for 7 58-year-old guys. Let's talk about some rule changes that when we were kids, we probably never thought we'd see these things. I'm just going to throw one out. So, okay. We already touched on the DH. I loathe the DH. It sounds like you don't like it either, but I'm grudgingly accepting of it. And I like the way you said the Mets don't like it either. That was really good. So let's talk about the pitch clock. Now, one thing I will say about that, I think I could say this definitively, whether anyone likes it or not, it hits its objective. The pitch clock is there to shorten the game and take the fat out. The games are shorter. They are 30, Gary Cohen showed the other day, 31, 32 minutes shorter, maybe even 36, somewhere in there. So it works. Now, whether or not you want that outcome is something different, but it does hit its intended objective. So what do you think of the pitch clock and how it's working?
I'm kind of fine with the pitch clock in part because it's in the rule book, right? Like the rule book has always said maybe it's not the exact numbers. I don't like the 8-second thing. I feel like if the batter's not in the batter's box, that's his fault. Like I don't like that. But I think it's okay. I don't like the actual clock and having to see the clock. I feel like, you know, I'll trust the umpire if the umpire is going to do it. But it doesn't bother me as much as I thought it would. I'm okay on that. I don't like the outlawing of the shift. I happen not to like the shift, but I don't think you outlaw it like this. I think that's, again, I like the effect of what's happened, but I feel like I would rather have seen the athletes have to learn how to adjust to the shift. I'm all for the bigger bases. I think that's cool. And I haven't even really noticed the bigger bases. The one that is intolerable, unacceptable, and I will never approve of is the ghost runner. I feel like that is an abomination on the game. And it's just like, what are we, 12? I mean, come on. Or at least give us 3 innings. Give us till the 12th. Like, just stop it with the 10th inning. I mean, it's just the game is it's a joke. I can't stand it. And I've gotten in arguments with people who love it. And I just feel like, all right. I mean, it's fine, but it's not. It's just not baseball. What are you doing? Like, it's so random. It's random. It's like this arbitrary thing. I don't like it.
Very much so. But what about the 2 disengagements? Because we are seeing now. You and I grew up with Vince Coleman, and we grew up with other, Ricky Henderson, all these people stole a lot of bases. With the 2 disengagements, we clearly are seeing more stolen bases. I think they're up by 50%, through games of attempts are up about 50%. So what do you think of the limit to 2 disengagements?
I don't like it. I don't like anything like that. I don't like, you can only visit the mound so many times. You only get so many challenges. I feel like it's just – like, just play the normal game. Stop. It's just too many rules. Like, then we're becoming like football. It's like there's too many rules. Like, just play, try and pick them off. Try and pick them off again. Try and pick them off. You can't pick them off. Keep trying to pick them off. Fans are booing. Who cares? Like, that's part of the game. I don't like that. And frankly, I could probably talk myself out of the pitch clock if I kept thinking about it some more. I mean, I think there are other things they could have done to speed up the game, like maybe cut down the commercial time from 2.5 minutes to 1.5 minutes, or maybe even 1 minute, get them on and off the field faster. And we'll have, there's 18 minutes or 27 minutes I can lose right there from every game just by cutting the commercial time. Like, that has a lot to do with it, I think. But anyway, I recognize I'm just an old man shaking my fist at the clouds and, lamenting the day. I mean, the fact is, how many rules am I going to like that are different from how baseball was when I was 10 years old? So it's like, just give me the game when I was 10. It was a great game. I didn't like the American League. I liked the National League. We didn't have the designated hitter. Okay, so.
Right where I am with that one. So maybe I'd like to share this one with you. I'm not sure if you saw this, but this is going to blow your mind. in the Atlantic League, which is typically where MLB, you know, tests out these. Do you know what they're doing this year? I hope you're sitting down.
I'm lying down. Is it, what is it? It's like.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Tell me, Rich, because I can't remember. I just remember it was. It made me so angry. Like I didn't read the article. You know.
Designated runner who is not in the starting lineup and can come in the game at any time, including reentry. So the guy could literally score from first, come from first home on a double up the gap, and go right back in and run for the guy who hit the double. So it's a designated runner with unlimited reentry. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it just seems like the game is not being run by people who love the game, you know? And that's the real, there have been a few real horrible moments in baseball history, and the death of Bart Giamatti is often overlooked. Like, there was a guy who was a strong commissioner who loved the game. And then, you know, they put in Faye Vincent, who also, I think, loved the game, but wasn't nearly as strong. And then the owners took it over, and then it became Selig, who was just, you know, don't get me started. And since then, it's been like, you know, we're just trying to make money. We're just here to make money. We don't care about the game. And in the end, that's not actually how you grow the product or make as much money as you could have if you, in fact, preserved and protected the actual game. I feel like they just, you know, and they're just trying to be like the NFL, MLB, the MLB. Yeah, the National League and the American League. And never the twain shall meet, you know. Then you have a World Series that means something. But, you know, I mean, interleague play has so long since sailed. But now there's one other thing that we haven't discussed, and I would like to discuss it if we can, and it's what happened in Texas yesterday and what is going to continue to happen, health willing, in Texas over the next 5 years. I feel like his whatever happened, and maybe we will never know, the way that went down was so bad and so terrible. And here was a guy who clearly, and he hasn't lost a step. I mean, he's very fragile. He's like a thoroughbred. But he was there. He was arguably the second best, if not the best pitcher the Mets have ever had. And he had a chance to have a statue right out there up, you know, in front on at 41 Seaver Way. And the fact that he's now going to continue his career with another team, I find just so, it's like a heartache. It's like an ex-girlfriend. It's just so painful. And I don't know how other Met fans are coping with having Jake DeGrom pitching in Texas, and maybe they don't care. Like, I wasn't even a DeGrom guy. I was a Harvey guy. But what happened with DeGrom and the way he developed and what he became in 2018, 2019, 2020, and especially the first half of 2021, that was the best pitching I'd ever seen. It was better than Gooden. And I'm just heartsick. And seeing what he did yesterday, I was just like, this guy. Like, I was kind of hoping when he took himself out of that game with the wrist thing, I was like, all right, well, maybe this is just going to, you know, fritter away and it'll seem like a wonderful thing that we didn't sign him and he's just injury prone and forget it. And it's like, no, he's still great. And, you know, he's going to be amazing and have a second half of his career like, you know, Nolan Ryan or Verlander or Clemens or any of these guys who pitch really well, really late into their careers. So I just feel like I can't be on a Mets podcast and not talk about Jake DeGrom.
Fair enough. The other, for those who may not know, yesterday, I believe, 6 innings, 11 strikeouts, 2 earned runs, and one of them was a home run. I think maybe both came on a home run, so it's one bad pitch. But that's what he's been doing. He did not have a good game, his first game against the Phillies, but he's been on the mound.
A terrible opening day, and then since then he's been DeGrom. And, it's just, and he's just unhittable, you know.
He is. Okay. Now, let me ask you this, though. I would have given DeGrom, my opinion, I would have given him Scherzer money, would have matched Scherzer, Verlander money for 3 years, maybe with a team option, depending on any pitch for a fourth. I personally would have gotten the heebie-jeebies about giving him 5 or 6 years just because of his durability. But would you have been comfortable with that, which is a fine alternative. I mean, but it sounds like you would have been.
No, I don't begrudge whatever offer we gave him. It seemed like it was maybe a little low. I begrudge what, if the story is true, I begrudge that DeGrom didn't come back to us and say, "Do you guys want to match?" Because then at least we would have had the decision to make, and it would have been our decision. I feel like he didn't want to be here, and he never, mm-hmm. he was not a city guy. He's from, you know, from Florida, whatever. He seems like he's a MAGA guy, wants to be in Texas, fine. But it's just painful. It's painful how good he was and that he didn't really want to be here was distressing after how good and how important he was and could have been. He could have been the bridge to, you know, our next championship, which could happen as soon as this year. That being said, there is the old Patrick Ewing theory, and we weren't winning with him. We hadn't won with him, and so let's see if we can win without him.
Interesting. To me, it would have been great to have him back. This will go one of two ways. I don't see a middle ground here. Either he breaks down, whether chronically or permanently, you know, and he's in and out and all of that. And those who say they should not have brought him back are like, "See that? We were right. You see that? See that?" Or the other side is he pitches like he's been, and he, to use your term, he has a Verlander-like, you know, Ryan-like second half of twilight of his career, and he's this good for the next, even if it's four of the next 5 years, then it's egg on the face. You also said that he seemingly did not want to be here, whether it was New York City, whether it was, you know, the whole political thing, or whether it was the taxes. Some people say that.
Right, the taxes thing. I mean, there's a lot suggesting that he really just didn't want to be here, which is fine. And you know, Seaver always said it wouldn't have happened with Nolan Ryan if he'd stayed in New York. Like, Nolan Ryan didn't like it in New York. He wasn't ever going to succeed in New York. But DeGrom had succeeded in New York. So he'd proven that he could do it in New York. I think he just wanted to do it somewhere else, in which case, you know. I mean, also, I feel like these opt-out things, like he signed a contract. Like, just honor the contract, all right? Like, it was $138 million, like, 3 years ago. It was a good contract. So it's hard with these guys sometimes.
It is. And this one, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I was watching the game. You might've been as well when the wrist thing happened. You know, he's 4 no-hit innings. Right. And then where's Jake? Oh, the Texas announcer, like, we don't know why he left the game. He left the game. And then it seemingly took forever for them to come out with what exactly it was. And the wrist is not something I had on my bingo card. And that's not something he had ever,
right,
complained about before, right? Elbow, shoulder, this and that, but never the wrist. So if he did not miss any time, I think it was one day pushed back. He didn't miss anything. So we'll see. It's just something to keep an eye on with him. His health, if that man is healthy, he is the best to take the mound. He is. He's better than Gerrit Cole. He's better than Zach Wheeler.
He's better than anybody. He's better than anybody. I mean, when he's right, he's the best. And it's weird how good he is, but he just is. So yeah.
He is.
Anyway.
So Nick, I want to say a pitching. I know we're going to let you go soon. Oh, just one more thing I wanted to get to, because as the Mets start to go into May, and I want to talk about the starting pitching. Now, glass half full. Okay. Scherzer. The suspension may not be the worst thing in the world, because Buck has said many, many times, I want to manage innings with these guys. You said it earlier, have them fresh in October. Miss 10 days, not so bad. All right, glass half full with that. Also, Verlander coming back May 3rd, provided his rehab start goes well. Okay, so you have the cavalry is coming to a degree. However, McGill and Peterson have not been good. They were the depth. Now, with Quintana going down, the Mets had to tap into depth early, and that depth is now here and not doing so well. So my question to you is, how would you like to see the Mets manage this? I see two paths. You could stay internal, and you could say we have Buehler if we need him. We have Lucchesi, McGill and Peterson. This could just be a blip. You know, they might get better.
I think with McGill it's a blip. I'm not worried about McGill. Peterson, I think, has – you know, there was a – I don't know if you remember when we were kids, but I think it was Ken Clay. George Steinbrenner said, we've seen enough of Mr. Clay.
Yes.
And they sent Ken Clay packing to where I think it was Columbus at that point. I'm almost ready to say I've seen enough of Mr. Peterson. I just don't think he's ever going to be any better than he's been. And he's never really been much more than like David West. McGill, I feel differently about. McGill, I feel like, is a bulldog. He reminds me of Harvey and to some extent even DeGrom. I think he can get bit by the home run ball, which Verlander can and Scherzer can. But I still believe in McGill. I didn't actually see yesterday's game, so I don't know. But I like McGill. I was all for getting Verlander because we've just been, you know, burned by DeGrom. I don't see a lot of pitchers out there trading block who I feel like are going to be any better than what we have. I like Senga. I like, you know, if we have Senga and Verlander and Max and McGill and Lucchesi. I mean, I don't know how good Lucchesi is actually going to be, but he looked great the other night. And mm-hmm. Buehler, like, that's, I mean, I don't know. How much more can you get?
So I think you've answered my question. I was going to ask you if you'd take a shot at Madison Bumgarner.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I think you look at his stats over the last, you know, whenever he joined the Diamondbacks, he just doesn't seem to have very much left at all. And he's not, it's weird. When it goes, it goes. I wouldn't take a shot on him.
To me, if he ends up being released and the Mets become liable only for the, I think it's $720,000 major league minimum, give him a start or two, because Peterson, you're right, I'm over Mr. Peterson as well. And frankly, could he be worse than Peterson? Or we could just say, you know what, screw the whole idea of an experiment and let's just stick with the internal options. Lucchesi, my God, did he look good on Friday night. You know, Lucchesi, Buehler. Quintana will be back. I mean, he's saying he'll be back in August, which seems like an eternity, but it will come, and he will be back. So, yeah, we could build it internally. Fair enough.
I think so. I mean, I think Bumgarner could give you one great start, and that would be exciting. And especially his first start, like that might be a thing where, like, he just summons, you know, the Mad Bum of 2014, and, like, that's amazing. But I don't know. It's not something to really count on. I would like to see them start selecting, you know, incredible high school pitchers in the draft and just like build up a young pitching staff. To me, the Mets are the Mets because of young pitching. And when the Mets don't have young pitching and when they're building around guys like Verlander and Scherzer, I feel very like sort of like, okay, and they're aces and that's great. But I just feel like I need my Harveys and my DeGroms and Thor and, you know, like those are, that to me is when the franchise is most exciting, is when you have a young pitching staff that you can build around. You know, Seaver, Kuzman, Matlack, Gooden, Darling, you know, Fernandez. Like that's when I'm most excited. Now, sometimes that's Pulsifer and Wilson and Isringhausen, it doesn't work out. But when it works, it's pretty exciting. So
Flushing baseball. You know, the Yankees, Bronx Bombers, right? They build when they win, they win with offense. The Mets, when they've won with pitching. Let's be honest. That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
And young pitching, you're right. Young pitching at that. You know, 69 and 73, I believe. Seaver in 69 might have been 23, 4, and 73. He was in his mid to late 20s. So, you know, Kuzmin, Gentry, yeah. like the guys you mentioned. So, Nick, I want to say that it has been an absolute pleasure. I know we've kept you a little longer than we expected. And I think Sam said about an hour. So, but I want to say it's been an absolute pleasure for me, I'm sure for the listening audience as well, to have an opportunity to talk baseball with you and to hear about your storied career and the works you've done, and of course focusing on Once Upon a Time in Queens, which of course is near and dear to the hearts of Mets fans. So, Nick, as a renowned television and movie producer, it's been great having you on. Is there any other topic that you'd like to either raise or discuss with us, or do you think we've covered it?
I think we've covered it. I'm glad you gave me a chance to talk about DeGrom, because I feel like there's this wound in the 2023 Mets that just won't go away, for me anyway. But I am, you know, look, I mean, we haven't mentioned Steve Cohen, and I gather you guys talk about him all the time. I we're still finding our way in this brave new world of the Steve Cohen regime. It's so exciting and so fresh and fun to have ownership that is backing the team this way, that it's just a joy. And whatever his, you know, issues as a businessman may be, it's just great that he's on our side. He's our owner. He's the Mets owner. So,
can you believe that 3 short years ago we were dealing with Michael Wacha and Rick Porcello as the big offseason acquisitions, and now we're talking about Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer, Francisco Lindor, the list goes on. So Nick, I'm going to talk out of the other side of my mouth for just 1 second here. So I said, you know, we're so happy to have you, which of course we are. We were going to let you go, but there's somebody on the line who might want to say hello to you, and I'm going to bring Sam Maxwell, who set this all up. And Sam, Nick, I know you think you guys know each other, so have at it.
Hey, everybody. I obviously didn't – I wasn't able to listen to the first part, so I don't want to go too crazy with repetition, because obviously you guys might have specifically regarding the Mets that I would be repeating. But, you know, I'm happy to be able to call in. I'm happy that you guys were able to talk Mets tonight. You know, and Rich, I know you're always asking exactly where I am. I am at 8th Avenue and 56th Street, so right in the heart of it.
Very exciting. So, Sam, you know, it's good to hear your voice. I lived on that block, on 56th Street, between 8th and 9th. Yeah, for 5 years. So I know that
that's
block
so funny.
Well,
yeah. Serendipitous it is, apparently.
Even more serendipitous is that, Sam, I believe tonight you were doing improv. And, Nick, I read about you that you did some improv. You started some improv, right, when you were in college.
Yeah, I did improv in college. And then when I was on 56th Street, I was doing quite a lot of improv. I think of improv and 56th Street as, you know, that was the same moment in my life. But it's been a joy talking Mets with you, Rich. And, Sam, yeah, I think we covered a lot of ground here, but I think we're in agreement that this is a good time to be a Mets fan. It's not necessarily a great time, just because of where this season is right now. But I feel very, very good about this team and this season.
Sam?
Yeah, and I, you know, to reiterate that, you know, especially coming off those two losses, there obviously was some things that I wish they had done better in those last two games on the West Coast trip. You know, I know a lot of people want to poo-poo the fact that 3 of those wins were against the Athletics, but you still have to win those games one way or another. Obviously, the Giants don't look as strong, but they're still – formidable. I hate losing to the Dodgers and the Giants, and so it does burn a little bit that 3 of the losses on the road trip were against the Dodgers and the Giants, but they're always – all those games are always competitive unless Clayton Kershaw is just doing what he normally does. But, you know, they're always exciting. Anytime we play our ancestors, the two uniforms, whether it's Dodgers or Giants, look good on the field together, the Mets and those two teams. So, you know, it's always something you dread, a West Coast trip like that, the A's notwithstanding. But it's still, like, even if it's, like, a sour taste in the mouth at the end, you got to be happy with a 7-3 road trip.
Yes, yes. I think, obviously, 8-2 would have been much, 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 much better.
And especially the way that game went.
Yeah, it's just like, just, you know, all right, fine, they can have Saturday. Just give us Sunday, and we couldn't get it done. Anyway, guys, I do need to go, but I can't thank you enough for inviting me. And, you know, I hope I get to come on and do the playoff preview episode after I clinch a spot. Because I'm firmly convinced we'll be in the playoffs this year, and that's all that matters, is that we get in and we're healthy at that time, and Verlander and Scherzer and Senga are cooking with gas as we approach October.
To God's ears, Nick, to God's ears. We want to thank you very much for joining the Mets Team Podcast. We're going to let you go, and Sam, it's great that you got to call in for a minute here. Nick, very much, the pleasure was mine, and we will have you back anytime. You're always welcome here.
Thank you so much, guys. It was great. Have a good night.
Have
you
a good
well.
Night,
thanks,
everybody.
Nick.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye.